Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, May 1934, J. Edgar Hoover takes over as the head of the Bureau of Investigations, which is a predecessor to the FBI, after William Burns is forced to resign. Now, you may be thinking to yourself, here's a nice little angle for this podcast to talk about Hoover, who, of course, ruled the FBI for decades and decades, one of the most influential and interesting characters in American history. But no, let's actually look at the guy that Hoover was replacing, the guy on his way out the door, William Burns, because Burns was indeed the head of the Bureau of Investigation at that moment and was, before Hoover came along, the most famous intelligence officer in America. And he was a huge cultural figure, too, often referred to as America's Sherlock Holmes. So let's talk about why William Burns was forced to resign. And also, this is our chance to do a little profile of a very interesting character who got up to a lot of stuff, got his fingers in a lot of pies, I would say. So here to do that, as always, Nicole Hammer of Vanderbilt and Kelly Carter Jackson of Wellesley. Hello there.
Hello, Jody.
Hey there.
You want to start at the beginning or at the end? You want to talk about why he's on his way out? Or
it's
how
a mystery, Jody. We've got to start at the beginning.
Yes. Oh, really? That's how it works? Don't you show the what do they call it? The body drop at the beginning?
Let's show the body.
Historians need chronology. Yeah. We need
he's on his way out in this moment because he's super corrupt. There's my historical analysis.
But he wasn't always. I mean, when you think of Burns, he is this person you had mentioned being like sort of the Sherlock Holmes. He was known for being a special investigator, for, being that guy that you called when you needed to solve a murder or you needed to solve a particular kind of crime. He wrote exploits about all of his crime stories, sort of like the OG of true crime stories in terms of telling about them. But he had a reputation for honesty. People trusted him. He was known as the person who could always sort of catch the bad guy, find out the whodunit, and people valued that about him initially.
He was his own Arthur Conan Doyle. He wrote his own exploits for the public. It was, yes.
Well, and if we could take a step back, I mean, he was somebody, he was born in Baltimore. He was raised in Columbus, Ohio. He was somebody who wanted to become an actor, and his father didn't want him to. So he parlayed those skills into undercover work later in his life. But he had fallen in with an old con and a forger, a guy named Charles Ulrich, when he was still a teenager. And he was so taken by this world of fraud and underground crime that he begins to dedicate himself to life as a private detective. And he starts his own detective agency, like literally the William Burns Detective Agency. And he goes around as kind of a private investigator to solve crimes. And he does such a good job of it that he is eventually hired by the federal government to run the Bureau of Investigation. Right. So it is like a very, I don't know, it is one of those stories where all of the pieces are falling into place early on for the character that he is going to become.
Right. Let's linger that moment before he's brought into the fold of the government, because this is a moment when a lot of law enforcement and intelligence is happening in this kind of like freelance, ad hoc, very decentralized way. And so a big part of the story, and certainly part of Hoover's story, is that like that becomes institutionalized. But in this moment, you have people like entrepreneurs like William Burns who are floating around and getting called into big cases. I want to talk about some of the cases that he gets called into. But, you know, one thing that strikes me about his approach is often he gets called in and he finds the guys who did it. And often they are powerful and corrupt. And he kind of gets a reputation for being honest and going after the powerful. And he kind of strikes me as a inverse Pinkerton, right? And the Pinkertons were called in often on behalf of the corrupt to be the heavies, to lay down the law, to protect their interests, to, you know, intimidate the press, break up union organizing, yada, yada, yada. And Burns, at least in this moment, seems like the opposite of that. He comes in and he actually sort of points out that where all the corruption and the powerful forces are aligning behind a story.
And he appears at this moment when there is an uptick in crimes that need solving, not just in like petty crimes, but you know, as we've talked about in other episodes, in the early 20th century, there was kind of a terrorism spree in the United States. There were all of these bombings that were happening. The Los Angeles Times building is bombed in 1910. There are bombings happening across Detroit and Chicago in 1911. Just like throughout that first decade of the 20th century, there are all of these bombings, and he is sent in as kind of this counterterrorism expert in a period before that's a thing, and helps to crack the case on a lot of these crimes, sometimes by going undercover, sometimes just through pretty diligent police work to trace where dynamite was bought in order to kind of weave together the clues for who was responsible for these crimes.
And what's miraculous or incredible is that he sort of takes a series of bombings that have taken place, and he, you know, cracks the case and finds out that the person who's behind a lot of these bombings is none other than the Union Secretary Treasurer John McNamara, who is of the Ironworks Union in Detroit. And that not only is he behind, you know, a few bombings, but he finds out that he had either knew of or approved of over 100 bombings between 1905 and 1910. I don't know, one of the largest domestic terrorism campaigns in American history. So he's doing monumental work at this time.
Yeah, I mean, we should do episodes on this, but the spate of bombings that have their way up to the very corrupt Iron Workers Union in this moment, including that LA Times building bombing, which killed 20 people, you know, I mean, stories that are lost to time. 20 people at the LA Times building died when the building was bombed in 1910. And that was, I guess, because the iron workers were basically targeting places that were using non-union labor. And then they went on to do, hundreds of bombings in this era. And Burns is the one who kind of uncovered that. You know, this is also the era, just to paint the larger picture. We've touched on this a number of times. But, you know, it's like where there's lots of bombings. Bombings is the, like, you know, tool de jour, tool de era, tool de decade or whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's all these rumors that it's anarchists behind it, and then often it's not anarchists, or it could be anarchists, or it could be the government setting up anarchists, and there's unions involved, and private enterprises involved, and so forth. And we've touched on a number of those in here, and Burns was kind of like, got a reputation for being someone who could come in and pull all the strands apart. So as we get out of the teens and into the 20s, the Bureau of Investigation comes calling. What is your sense there about why he gets brought into the fold?
Well, he has an enormous reputation by this point in time. One of the things that we've hinted at but haven't quite leaned into yet is that he was a pretty great self-promoter, that he was such a colorful figure, that his exploits get covered in all of the newspapers. And so when the Bureau of Investigation is tossing around for someone who can deal with, you know, still in the 1920s, bombings continue to be a major part of the kinds of things that the Bureau of Investigation will investigate. The Wall Street bombing had just happened in 1920. So there is this real sense that this is going to be the guy who is going to be able to crack these cases. So let's put him in charge of the Bureau. Let's give him the tools that he needs in order to do these big federal investigations. And so he is put in charge.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't hurt, though, that one of his good friends, a guy by the name of Harry Daughtry, is the attorney general. And so at the
time, does not hurt.
Yeah. Warren Harding is president and basically says to his attorney general, hey, do you know a guy? And he's like, oh, I know a guy. And next thing you know, Burns is taking up this position, and he does a lot of things that people might consider progressive. You know, he sort of shrinks the Bureau from about 1,100 employees to about 600 employees. He hires, you know, the first woman special agent, a person by the name of Alaska Davidson.
Made up name. That seems like
clearly an alias.
Alaska P. Davidson. Come on.
And another woman by the name of Jessie P. Duckstein in 1923. So all of this seems to be going well until pretty much you hit this scandal that undermines his whole career.
Hey there, Jody here, and I'm excited to tell you that one of our favorite Radiotopia siblings, Ear Hustle, is back with a brand new season. This is their 13th season, and the show just keeps getting better. Now, I don't know if you know, but Ear Hustle is the show about life inside prison, but it is not your typical prison podcast. Co-hosts Nigel Poor and Erlon Woods have recently been spending time at four California prisons, and now they have a season's worth of funny, surprising, and unforgettable stories to share. In a recent episode, they were able to visit a groundbreaking prison hospice where they spoke to men who are grappling with the reality of dying inside prison. Also coming up this season are stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells, complicated mom-daughter relationships inside prison, and stories of incarcerated people who wonder whether they've become too comfortable behind bars. These are stories about life on the inside told by those who live it. I'll be listening, and I hope you will too. Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts. Before we get to the scandals, two other things jump out at me. I mean, one, you know, you point out that like Harding brings him in, and you have Doherty, who's the attorney general. And, you know, you read anything about Doherty, like he clearly, I think this is like attorneys general really like people who end up in that job like power, believe it or not, and they have enemies. And so, you know, there's someone who like really wanted to go after his enemies and use the Justice Department and had this little, people refer to as this little den of thieves between the three of them, Harding and Doherty and Burns. And they would just kind of like sit around and play poker and drink and talk about who they were going to go after. And then the other thing that jumped out to me was that while he's the head of the BOI, Burns continues to run the Burns Detective Agency as a side enterprise, which just, you know.
Because there's no conflict of interest there.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, if I were to go get a job, I might say, you know, I still host this podcast on the side. Can I continue doing that? That's different from saying, you want me to be the top law enforcement officer in the United States, but I also have a private company that also conducts investigations into the very same things that you might be asking me to do. So, I mean, you know, there's a whiff of this guy's got a little too much dip on his chip from the beginning.
Yes. And a lot of, this was a pretty corrupt administration, the Harding administration. And in fact, it is going to be known as, until we get like into the 70s, as one of the most corrupt administrations in U.S. history. Mm. And so it is no wonder that his attorney general and that his head of the Bureau of Investigation would also be part of this corruption, because it was the way that that administration, that White House was working. Not, you know, not the only corrupt administration in U.S. history, but it certainly was not discouraged to be corrupt in the Harding administration.
So much of this is unique to this moment, but also just strikes me as like right out of the How Things Unravel playbook. One of them is that, you know, there's this whiff of corruption across the administration, as we just pointed out, and the press loves it. They start to write about it and cover it pretty deeply. And you have what becomes known as the Doherty Burns scandal, which is just kind of corruption within the intelligence community. And so what does Burns do? Well, he uses his forces to go after the press, right? And that just feels like you open the I'm under a cloud of suspicion playbook and I'm a powerful person playbook. And the page one says, start attacking the press, which tends to backfire. Yes. I guess we only know about it when it backfires. But yeah. And so that's what's happening here. And Doherty is brought up on fraud charges. I guess the precipitating thing that really leads to Burns' unraveling, this walks us into something we haven't done an episode on, in part because I've always felt like it's just too complicated. And so we don't have to unravel it here. But the Teapot Dome scandal, which I'm sure is a phrase, three words that people have heard before, but that enters here as well. Teapot Dome scandal involved oil executives. So without having to explain the Teapot Dome scandal, can you tell us how Burns at least plays into that sprawling affair?
So in November of 1927, Harry Sinclair is on trial for conspiracy. And what he does is he hires Burns, who then hires a team of investigators to go after the people who will be jurors on Sinclair's case. And he basically pays off the jurors, you know, convinces them to vote in a particular direction so that when the trial happens, it's almost immediately declared a mistrial. And Burns is pretty much behind all of that and doing Sinclair's dirty work for him.
And Burns, you know, he's the head of, again, head of the Bureau of Investigation is intimidating jurors in this case that involves the President of the United States. He's ultimately sentenced to 15 days imprisonment for tampering with the jury pool, other than the Supreme Court gets involved and reverses the conviction. Yeah. So he is up to his eyeballs in corruption and in this scandal that's unfolding. The Harding was dead by this point, but that's unfolding over the course of the 1920s.
So at that point, basically, Burns gets driven out. And that is how we come back to this moment where Hoover takes over. Hoover's 29 years old when he takes over. It's part of the reason it felt like Hoover was around forever. It's because he took over the FBI when he was 29 years old. And he had been pals with Burns. He was brought in. But, you know, time is a flat circle. All these narratives just keep coming back around. What is Hoover's reputation when he comes in? He's seen as progressive, honest, efficient, anti-corrupt, you know, in response to the guy who had just gotten corrupted by government forces after he'd come in with the same reputation. And of course, we all know how that went for Hoover. So, you know, at some level, I think this is more than anything a story of just kind of how the people who end up in these positions are often ones who are driven and egomaniacal and petty, and now they're handed the keys of an apparatus that can sort of do lots of things to satisfy those urges, you know, and so
urges for just, power and control,
vindictiveness and all that stuff.
And also a reminder why you need agencies of oversight and checks and balances, because you can put the most progressive, honest, and efficient people in these positions, but that is no guarantee that they will retain those characteristics once they're in office.
All right. Well, that brings us to the end of our episode about America's Sherlock Holmes, Burns. One little interesting tidbit is that that first female agent that he hired, whose name is made up, Alaska P. Davidson, Hoover, of course, fired her and then didn't have any female agents for like decades and decades after that. But that's part of Hoover's story, not Burns' story. but we will leave it there. Oh, wait, one more thing. I have to say this. Sorry. But as I was reading about Burns, he's William Burns, Bill Burns. But then I did read a reference to him as, you know, FBI agents are sometimes known as dicks, right? And he was called at times, because his reputation was so large and he was really renowned, he was referred to once as the King of Dicks. Which made me smile.
Oh, God.
We don't nickname people like we used to.
No, we don't.
I mean, I've called somebody the King of Dicks before.
Yeah, but this was apparently
a
big...
But it was not a compliment, was it?
It was a complimentary nickname. There he is, the King of Dicks.
Oh, so, gosh. And we're going to end it on that note.
We're absolutely
going to end it on that note.
Nicole Hammer, thanks to you.
Thanks, Judy.
And Kelly Carter Jackson, thanks to you.
My pleasure.
Radiotopia from PRX.